Have you some Emma Bridgewater in your home? A polka dot mug or a black toast cereal bowl or a rose and bee teapot? All these homely pieces of pottery are handmade in Stoke in England. And it all started with a few sketches and a desire to create something that Emma could not find. A cup and saucer for her mum's birthday. Now it is a thriving business employing 300 people with a turnover of 11 million last year. Emma Bridgewater, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. What very nice nice things you've said.
Oh.
I'd like to think people might have, beyond pottery, they might have a tea towel or a biscuit tin or some hand cream. More recently, we've been doing some very, very nice body and bath things with
nice
florists.
As well.
Yeah,
with
lovely.
Florists.
Yes.
God,
I mean,
nice.
Not the florist name, but the florist making.
God,
so lovely,
really
high quality, and made in Tiverton, which I particularly like. I like a nice, handy, local English factory.
Yeah, is that one
possible
of your things, that most things are made in England?
It's sadly not possible to get tin, for example, made here, but if it were, I would definitely buy that. We always try and source it here. I have a huge preference for that. We've just done a... I'm plugging away very quickly, aren't I? We've just done a huge project with Sanderson to do furnishing fabric, big collection of furnishing fabrics and wallpapers. And to my amazement, those are all made here. Isn't that great?
It's brilliant, brilliant. So you're primarily here to talk about one of the most enchanting and beautiful books that came out this year. It's a memoir. It's a picture book called Toast and Marmalade and Other Stories. I've got it here. So Emma Bridgewater's been going for 30 years. Why right now?
I've been stalked by a very lovely agent, very persuasive agent, for some years, who read something, some paragraph or something I'd written somewhere, and had been saying, come on, write a book, which is jolly nice. And it suddenly felt like it was the moment. I couldn't exactly say why.
Emma told me that she went to Paris to write her book and really enjoyed the experience of living in a new city. She's also got ideas about going to live in another city, Stoke, where her factory is. So I asked her, what is there for you to do in Stoke?
We've just had our first literary festival there this weekend. Hundreds and hundreds, an enormous number of people turned up. We sold out all, I think there were 12 events. We had an incredible roster of big names. Andy McNabb's our patron. How wonderful is he?
So is he local? Stoke?
No. But he really believes that literacy is the only hope. Stoke's a place with... It's a city that's struggling to reinvent itself post mining, post potteries, post heavy industry. And there's a lot of unemployment, so very bad. Big, bold, bad challenges to in terms of the literacy, the crime, the health, blah, blah, blah. And Andy is sort of in like Flynn, wherever someone explains to him that there's a real, you can make a difference. And he does this really charismatic. And we had people like Anthony Beaver, David Starkey, Joanna Trollope, Lauren Child. It was amazing. It was really, really fantastic. We ended up with Melvin Bragg yesterday afternoon.
And this was your first one. God! What's it going to be next?
It's going to be absolutely amazing.
Exactly. Your mother was the inspiration behind the business. Can you tell us about your relationship with her?
My mum was just completely fantastic. Everyone thinks that, don't they, really? She was inspiring and gorgeous and very, very... She was one of those hospitable people who made any meal a party, any event... Very easy. She didn't really mind who I brought home, how many. Earth mother. She's quite hippie. She brought us up on a bit of a shoestring, lots of lentils and all that kind of thing. And muesli, a terrible homemade muesli, a lot of homemade bread. Our life in Oxford was just lovely. It was a party, it was a picnic. This is Emma Bridgewater on Radio Gorgeous.
I then asked Emma if she ever thought she'd be the great success that she is.
I don't think I exactly had a plan. Do you think that's a girl thing? I could see what I wanted to do was be something before I got married. I had a very strong instinct. I guess I was watching my mum looking at the... she had five of us. And my youngest sister is loads younger than me, And I remember being very well aware that Mum was dreading her Clover going off to school and leaving home. It kind of somehow was very clear to me that those are your years, that very, very, very short time between school and the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And I don't think people realise when they're in it just how valuable it is.
Yes.
Before you commit, get married, start having children, which, and I suppose, so we push it off until later and later and later. And that's got its own complications. But it felt to me like I've got 5 years after university to do something. It doesn't really need to be, I don't need to complete it. I just need to establish something. And I guess that's exactly what I did. That was the only plan I had. I didn't have a sort of...
Because you read English at university, then you went to go and work with some knitwear women.
Yes.
So that was a bit crafty, so...
It was a bit crafty. It was just really good fun. It was a very good offset to my dad's very suited and booted business, which I'm sure was a huge driver for me. You tend to do what you know, don't you? And he was an entrepreneur. He's a publisher. Mm. The business that he built up throughout our childhoods went public while I was at university. So I kind of saw the inside of that. And I guess... all I knew really was to imitate that.
Mm, that's a good role model to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wanted my business to be bigger than his and to go public sooner.
Love it. That's very
But other than that, that's I didn't really have a plan. And when I went to work for Sal and Joe, the Jersey Girls, it really lit me up because they were having such fun and they were so unbothered and unambitious that it was delicious too. And what they were bothered about was making really lovely jerseys. And when the soon-to-be Princess of Wales wore one of them, if I describe it, you will remember it. It was red with white sheep and one black one.
Yes.
And every woman in the Western world wanted that jersey. And they reluctantly upped the numbers from, I don't know, 50 a week to 75 a week, going, oh, God, it's such a nuisance. They were brilliantly not over it, going, we've got to make lots of money off this.
Yeah.
And I loved being in their world. And I felt, if you could make a business feel like this, that would be so great. And so I saved up all of £300 or £400 or something. Any time in my whole life I've been in credit, I think. And having done various sort of holiday penances in my dad's business and 18 months with him, I thought, I know everything about businesses now. I'm going to stop.
Hysterical.
I was literally cruising for an idea when I had the revelation in the china shop that what the potteries were making was just absolutely in no way what the customer was looking for. It was all this sort of very formal white bone china, gold bands.
Emma then explained to me that her mother's dresser was the complete inspiration for her pottery.
What was needed for the kitchen that, and her kitchen sort of represented an ideal, a sort of very, a touchstone for me of colourful, mismatched, relaxed, goes in the dishwasher.
They feel like they're being made.
Someone's loved them.
Yeah.
Someone loved them and they were designing them and making them.
Yeah.
This is Gorgeous Lives, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
So the original, the mug, that's really famous. Is that the original, one of the original mugs that you drew? I'm wondering how close to your original vision it still is.
It's much closer than I thought it would be. I assumed, having only had that brief go in the sort of fuzzy end of fashion with the jerseys, that I'd be changing the patterns twice a year. I'd be producing collections of 20 designs twice a year and that I'd quickly progress through other decorative techniques. And I was all set for lustre and rubber stamping and doing lots of other things, which there's been an astonishingly sort of small, and there's been no need that what I did took hold.
So is it spongeware?
Yes. And it seemed to me that it was perfectly suited to me, and that what it isn't is sophisticated design.
Mm.
It's telling, pleasing motifs used either in repeat or freely, sort of freehand across the ware. And I knew that that was absolutely sort of perfect for me.
Everybody throws it down, looking for your good friend. None can be found. You better come in my kitchen. It's going
my vision was for sort of all the kit you wanted for your kitchen.
Crockery.
I needed to have a bowl and a jug and a dish. Was actually, those are the four pieces I originally made. And that was what I took up to Stoke with me, plus a drawing of a bowl and a jug and a dish that I had made from a sort of quintessence of my favourite pieces of pottery. And it had to be tight. I'm sort of instinctively quite practical. You know, I could see that starting off with 25 shapes would be too expensive and completely unnecessary. But it had to imply a whole dresser. And I remember drawing a bow, a star, a diamond, a whippet and a prawn very early on and cutting them out painstakingly.
So what stayed of those? I know the star stayed.
The same star. Oh. None of those exactly. I can show you some of them in the book. Mm. So sweetly, an old boyfriend gave me back the other day four pieces that I must have forced him to buy at the beginning.
Because you're getting from it, the very, you know, very early. You really want to keep all the stuff together.
Our archive is what you might call ragged, politely.
Yeah.
This is Emma Bridgewater on Radio Gorgeous.
When did it take off then?
Well, it took off immediately. It was this really extraordinary thing that I put the sample collection that I got together. A friend of Alex's took a photograph for me on Alex's dresser, and that picture I stuck on a piece of A4 paper with a list of the titles and the prices and a little bit of information about spongeware and what I was doing, and a handwritten postcard attached to it saying, if you don't mind, I'm going to get in touch with you in the next few days, see if I can persuade you to order. And I sent that to 120 shops, some of which I knew, some of which I'd spoken to already, most of which I found in the stockist details in the back of House and Garden. And almost all of those 120 shops ordered. It really was the right thing.
Was that frightening, that moment?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I was very, very, very massively ignorant. No idea of the consequences. No idea how I was going to cope with the cash flow or anything like that. No. But sure, I was going to make it work.
You didn't think about it. You just did it, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, and I think... That is the luxury of doing something when you're young, is you'll sort of go way beyond your possible. And when you're, you know, as you sort of dangle on the end of the diving board, that's when you'll start thinking about safety nets. And
so you went to the potteries, they made them, and got
I evolved the decoration, and then I took it back to, and then I took the sample collection back to Sam by arrangement and said, okay, this is what they're going to order. I taught his girls how to do the decorations. I cut the sponges all the time. I'd mixed up all the colors. He'd matched them commercially. I mean, all this was stuff I didn't know anything about, but that I learnt. Hugely aided and abetted by Sam by this stage. He was sort of absolutely crucial.
Emma then told me that she contracted rheumatoid arthritis in her mid-40s. She felt so ill that she was physically sick. The pain was so strong. And she didn't stop her life. She carried on going forward in the same manner. And then one day she met one of her mother's friends.
I just got this very brilliant message from a friend of my, old friend of my mum's, from way, way back, saying, just tell Emma that she will control the RA if she has to de-stress her life. She has to take out of her life the things that are driving her up a tree, and then it will be okay. And I didn't know what that meant. I couldn't think how to do it because I didn't know what to do except go on running the business because, you know, our mortgage depended on it.
Your mind
fees.
Was...
I was just sort of locked
beyond
in.
You. Yeah.
But when hearing this from Cindy made me know that I needed to think about it. Mm. And then I just suddenly thought, oh, Matthew could run the business. And for some reason, neither he nor I had the slightest inkling that he could or should do that. Even though I had been nearly dead of agony.
Mind for one moment.
I don't think so, no. Mm. And so over a weekend, we changed lives. We'd already committed to selling the house in Norfolk and moving to Oxford. And it's very strange when a very busy life stops dead. Mm. Not altogether nice. But when I'd got used to it, it's that gave me... You sort of have to make... getting better at your main project for a bit.
So how did you do it? I'm interested.
I took all the pills. It was simple.
Oh, I see. You let the sickness
I took the pills
come.
And
yeah.
watched a lot of movies yeah. and yeah.
Did you quilt?
Walked.
Did you quilt?
No, I was kind of... Some. It depends. Yes. I walked on Port Meadow. I walked around Oxford a lot. It didn't take very long to start to feel completely different.
So literally it's stress. Is it stress related then?
Yes. God. Do you think everything a lot is, of things yeah. might turn yeah. out to yeah. be? Mm. And what you don't want to do, friend who's just grappled very successfully with cancer, and I'm talking about autoimmune system breakdown, yeah. and which is what both are, mm-hmm. and what's going on when your body starts to attack itself. It's such an upsetting thought. Mm. The body that you have always really trusted suddenly turns out to be your enemy. And it is to do with not having looked after it. And if you grapple down whatever, you know, the thing that, you know, in my case, the rheumatoid arthritis, then you have got not to go back to your old ways. And I find that whenever I have changed my life, I do look after myself. I've just stopped with the trainer because I find myself having to get up at 6 a.m.
Oh no, that's not enjoyable.
No.
Yeah.
But I am much fitter, and I do know that I need more sleep and all that kind of thing. And if I don't, the rheumatoid arthritis just taps me on the shoulder and
so
goes.
It's quite good because it's
yes.
a signal to you.
Yes, yeah. and it was horrible at the time, but actually it was very positive, and I didn't have it half as badly as I mean. If you Google it, which I obviously did, what you learn is absolutely hair-raising. And I wasn't in... I mean, I know I've met people who've had such... I mean, just so much worse an experience than me.
You know what I want to ask is, so you gave your business over. Now, have you totally given it and do you totally entrust them? Or can you not... come on, it's your thing. You created it. There must be, you know. Don't you want to get involved?
It's a big question, and it's not entirely easy to answer. I'm mostly just so grateful to Matthew, and he did really well. Yeah, immediately. We're quite a bit bigger than 11 million now, thanks to him. And so mostly. I mean, I'm quite a pragmatic, sensible person. I don't want to be doing that stressful job. And in fact, watching him get very tired doing it, I know that, you know, at some stage we might have to find some more conventional management. I suppose in the book was sort of me reclaiming my life a bit. And some of the projects around the brand, like the Sanderson thing, which... I mean, of course, Matthew was involved in. But they feel like they're both of us. Something like that. It's not Matthew bossing it.
Mm-hmm. So you're involved in...
The place where we add value, yeah. both Matthew and I, is really only in design and marketing.
Yeah.
It's not really very sensible for either of us to run the company.
No.
It's quite an intriguing thing to have done. It taught me a lot, and it's an enormous privilege employing all those people, particularly in Stoke, but also in London. And in the other shops. It's an amazing, it's an extraordinary thing. But I don't feel I long to get my hands back on the levers, no. I do need to know that it is in part, I mean, it's sort of in part at heart mine. But really that's not a big problem. I do know that. And so something like this weekend at the festival, I felt very, very at home. I really like my relationship with the business at that point, where the factory turns out to be a fantastic venue to hold a literary festival with hundreds of people traipsing through, and some of them knowing all about the factory, some of them coming to Stoke for the first time, a lot of them first time visitors to Stoke, you know, a whole lot of exciting things going on that are. All very, very positive around the brand and the business, but which do represent sort of new territory that I can...
And are the designs going to change or are they going to keep the same? And will you be doing them?
Yes, I'll be doing them. Yes, Matthew will be doing them. I'm sure at times we'll do what we've already done a bit, which is to commission other design. That can be very, very nice. I hope, you know, I know we'll go on doing that. Will they change? Well, when you get to a place where sort of people recognise a name and they think there's a clear sort of impression of what the business is like.
Yes,
you know,
if
you think of Laura Ashley,
yes.
You know what, you've got something in your mind. Yeah. And so you have to do this really fascinating thing. Whenever you set out to organise a new catalogue with lots of new stuff in it, it's got to look exactly the same as the last one and completely different. So you're doing a very strange, really interesting kind of a balancing act. And what you use as your navigation aids are, firstly, what Matthew and I want to do. So we're sort of, we will always lob in new and original ideas that don't have any bearing on what we're selling at the moment and what the customer is saying. But we also steer by what the customers react to.
Yeah.
So we're very, very, very aware of the sales. So it's strange dealing with publishers who say, oh, I don't know how many you've sold.
Oh, God, what
a wonder. No idea. We'll tell you in 6 months' time.
God.
It's really strange. But yeah. No, it's not. I mean, that's what we used to be like.
Yeah.
But it does seem, I'm really intrigued because we live or die on daily sales figures. Yeah. I've had such a lovely time with my publishers, but nobody knows how many I've sold.
Brilliant.
But I think that's entirely normal in publishing. It doesn't. Well,
Emma Bridgewater, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. Toast and Marmalade and Other Stories is published by Salt Yard Books.
Thank you so much. I've had a lovely time.
It's going to be raining, I do.